Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year, a record 32 million Latinos will be eligible to vote, many for the first time. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won an estimated 66% of Latino voters. According to recent polls, Joe Biden has the support of between 45 and 64% of Latino voters. Bernie Sanders, who broke new ground in Latino communities during the primary, says in order for Joe Biden to win, his campaign needs to do a much better job of doing outreach. Chuck Rocha, the former senior advisor to the Bernie Sanders campaign, says as a Latino, he was sick and tired of hearing that Latinos don't vote. He says they will vote as long as you talk to them with cultural competency. And that is what they did with Bernie's campaign. Chuck Rocha writes about how they won the most Latino votes in Nevada, Texas, and California in his new book, T.O. Bernie, the inside story of how Bernie Sanders brought Latinos into the political revolution. With just 47 days in until the election, how is the Biden campaign reaching out to communities of color, especially in battleground states? Joining us to talk about this is Chuck Rocha. Chuck was a senior advisor to the Bernie campaign and author of the new book, T.O. Bernie. Originally from Texas, Chuck began his career as a union worker and became the youngest officer elected in the state. Hi, Chuck. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. And I followed you on Twitter. I watched you on the shows as you all won in state after state. It was amazing to learn about your incredible on the ground work. Before we get into that, Chuck, I really also enjoyed learning about you and your background. You grew up in rural East Texas. You were the son of a single mom. Your dad was Mexican. Your mom was white and Native American. Tell us a little bit more about how your childhood shaped the work that you do today.
Thank you so much for asking. And I think that it was important for me to tell this part of the story in the book because people don't understand what political consultants do. And I don't think they understand the oddity of the story that I bring to the table. And because political consultant is a microcosm of a really elite group of people at the highest level doing this work. And they all have went to the best colleges. They all know people. They're all socially connected. And it's almost impossible for somebody who never went to college, who doesn't have an education, who's not comes from any family wealth, who's not tied socially to somebody who's in the business, whose family's not. I mean, it's just an oddity the way that I got to this. Now, I tell you that to say that I wanted to be very direct about making a connection so that other young brown and black kids, or just anybody who grew up with modest means, could know by listening to my story that they too could make it one day, maybe in politics, if they get lucky like I did a lot and worked hard. So growing up on that farm in rural East Texas with a single mother living in a trailer house next to my white grandparents, watching all of them work shift work and do day labor jobs and just kind of live a regular lower middle class life of not having very much, never really going on any vacation, but watching my mother struggle, watch her work several jobs, me going to work in a factory myself when I was 19 after I had carried on a long tradition of babies having babies and had my own baby when I was 19 and then took full custody of him. And I had to live through the trials and tribulations that most Americans have to live through every day of how are you going to make ends meet? How are you going to do all of this? Never really ever thinking about politics and how the impact of politics would have on my life because nobody was involved in politics in my family. Nobody talked about it because we were all too busy trying to live or make a living. So, you know, when I deal with politicians who are trying to reach out to those people, I feel like I have a unique understanding of those people because those people are my people. And those people are most of Americans who don't have great wealth, who are just trying to play by the rules and work hard and feed their family and make it work every single day. And I think that makes me a better consultant than anything I could ever read in a book.
It also gives you such interesting and a unique perspective on all of this, because, you know, out here on the West Coast, we often hear about the consultants running these campaigns out of DC. And so many times they just seem so out of touch. They're living in a bubble. They don't really know what it's like to struggle. You write about the first time that your firm Solidarity Strategies connected with the Hillary Clinton campaign. You also write about GMMB, which is Jim Margolis's mega firm based out of Georgetown, who worked with Barack Obama. What other insights, Chuck, can you give us about these consultants and how they run these Democratic campaigns?
There's just a handful of these consultants who actually get to do all of the work. And it's just a really elite group of people who actually do decent work. Like many of them do some of the best political ads in the country. Nothing that I wrote was a slight towards the success or the expertise that these consultants do in their campaigns, because many of them make beautiful ads and beautiful mail and beautiful digital ads. The point I really wanted to drive home is that it's almost impossible for somebody to break into the hierarchy of this consultant realm that is literally 99% controlled by white women and white men. And up until probably 15 years ago, it was all white men. But white women have made great strides in creating wealth, creating big firms, Planned Parenthood, Emily's Lists, and folks like that who have kind of opened up the door so there could be more powerful women-owned firms. And, you know, I give them credit, and they run amazing operations. So now, you know, probably 20% of the marketplace is controlled by white women and the other 80% by white men. And I don't think that any of them have any one racist bone in their body or don't affiliate with black or brown folks or don't hire wonderful black or brown folks. The point of the matter is that because it's an insular job owning these firms that it's hard for us to break in. Let me make the point. I have been doing this work for 30 years. This is my 31st year. I've ran two presidential campaigns for Bernie Sanders. I have worked for Dick Gephardt when he ran for president, John Edwards. I was the national political director of the Steelworkers Union when Barack Obama was running and ran that operation from the union. I have worked on one campaign after another at the highest levels of every campaign. But I would tell you this to give you an idea. So that your listeners would know that I'm a senior strategist and somebody you would think gets to pick and choose their work. But I can sit here today and tell you that I've never in my entire life worked on a Senate race. I've never in my entire life worked on a top 20 congressional race directly for those candidates. I've never worked on a top tier governor's race. Keep in mind, I've made millions of ads, millions of mail pieces, and made the firm millions of dollars that have paid for what we'll get to later about the incubator of these young brown and black kids who've worked for me. But if I, the senior most consultant and Latino-owned firm in the country, can't break in to even work on a Senate race or a top-tiered congressional race or a governor's race, it's because once you get to that level, it's just a small group of consultants who run all of that work, and it's really determined by the party, the party committees, the DCCC, the DSCC, and the DGA. And if you're not in that club, you just don't get that work.
So how did you then come to work for the Bernie campaign? You have a really interesting segment in the book about how the first time you met Bernie was when you were both fighting against NAFTA.
It was learning the campaigns through the eyes of organized labor. I was a factory worker in East Texas, just a line worker, assembly worker, and got to go out and start doing some campaigns with the Texas AFL-CIO and then the national, just because I was a young activist and I was a young steward. I talk about this in the book. So that's what opened up my eyes to understanding what politics was. And one of the big legislative issues that the company was working on, the union was working on more so than the company, was the North America Free Trade Agreement under Bill Clinton, a Democrat, I mind you. And we were very much a manufacturing plant that could be unbolted and set in another country very easily and make these tires anywhere. So we were fighting against that NAFTA agreement. And I remember going to D.C. as a citizen lobbyist And that's where we got to go into the halls of Congress, which, again, is very intimidating for a poor country kid who's never been to college. And in these granite halls, I remember the floors being granite, me being as a builder and somebody who grew up on a farm understanding construction. I was awed at all the granite that I'd never really seen before. And it was there I got to meet Bernie Sanders, who was a stalwart for organized labor and had always been with the unions, especially around this issue of trade. So that was my first introduction to him. And then we would go on to meet many times when I went on, became the political director of the union.
Chuck, can you give us some insights into how you prepare candidates for debates? Because when I read that you first met Bernie over NAFTA, I got to say the first thing I thought about was how Trump went after Hillary on NAFTA. And I know he's going to do that in the first debate when he debates Biden. And I just wonder, how is Biden's campaign preparing him for that?
It's pretty simple. You just know what questions are coming and you work on the response. Now, the way that Bernie Sanders does that is not traditional. Like, most people get in a room and they have a bunch of people acting out the parts of other candidates. And, you know, you work on what we call, you know, pivoting. Like, if you don't want to talk about something, this is your pivot response. And then you want to get in this zinger line. It's like when you're doing TV. There are certain things when I do TV that I want to make sure that I say, so I drive the narrative. There are certain things that you teach your candidate to say, though, so they can drive the issue around something that may be uncomfortable for them, or maybe once or twice in their past when they were on the wrong side of an issue. You know, people would always come at Bernie Sanders about an old gun vote that he would have back in the day because he comes from a gun-friendly state of Vermont. And it voted, you know, in his earlier years, you know, with pro-gun stances, never for assault rifles or for, you know, multi-magazines or none of that crazy stuff. But he did have what the NRA would think would be a good vote in the beginning of his career. So he would always have to pivot to what he wanted to say about that. And he would say he's against assault rifles. He was on that bill and he's against this and that. And so you just have to prepare for that question. Bernie used to always get the question, speaking about Latinos, about this 07 immigration bill that he voted against. And if you noticed, he said it so much that he had to pivot down to where he said, yes, I voted against that bill, but I also voted against that bill with LULAC, who is the largest Latino-based membership organization in the world, and the AFL-CIO. It was a bad bill, and that's why I voted against it. So what I just did there for you is I pivoted away from something I didn't want to talk about because I probably was wrong on that issue at that point in time.
Today, we are speaking with Chuck Rocha, who is a senior advisor to the Bernie campaign. He's out with a new book, Tio Bernie, The Inside Story of How Bernie Sanders Brought Latinos into the Political Revolution. If you have a question for Chuck Rocha about what it's like to be so close to campaigns, what goes on behind the scenes, what it will take for the Biden campaign to reach out to communities of color, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You also write in your book, Chuck, and you talk about this, that most politicians speak to Latinos just 4 to 6 weeks before the election. But with the Bernie campaign, you all did that 6 months before the election, and that made a huge difference.
He made all the difference in the world. And I say that they start talking to Latinos 4 or 6 weeks before an election, if, with a big I and a big F, if they talk to them at all. And this is when you did the opening about the book. That's the reason I wrote the book. I wanted to prove once and for all that Latinos are a persuadable turnout universe. That means that that's a universe you should start talking to early and spend lots of money having lots of conversations to explain to them why they should vote for you. Where, in fact, they're normally treated like a GOTV universe, mistakenly a lot like black voters. And what that means is somebody who you know is going to be with you. And so you just start talking to them about the time early voting starts or the vote by mail ballots have hit the House, because they don't need persuading. They just need reminded to vote, which is just this old concept from the 70s and 80s. That's just never really changed, because smartly, the question you asked me about brown and black consultants, because there's never a brown or black person in the room getting to make those decisions on where that resources is getting spent. I know we'll have the time today to get to this, but that's another big reason why we won this vote is I was in the room. I was in the room where the decisions were made. There were other people who also gave me power to make decisions, like Bernie, like Jeff Weaver, like Faz. So when I'm in control of big, big swaths of the campaign, then I made sure that we would do things differently than had ever been done. And so starting early was the first thing after writing budgets to make sure that things would start and be funded early. And because I was also in charge of more or less building out the original campaign, I had hired a whole bunch of brown and black folks and women and multiracial folks to kind of make sure that the campaign reflected the overall democracy that we were trying to develop. And so all of those things were very intentional. They didn't just happen. But I would remind you and your listeners that don't happen if there's not somebody in the room that demands that it happen.
Right. And for example, you have a story about renting neon trucks, putting Bernie's name on it, and then playing the local Spanish radio station just to let people know that we are in your neighborhood and we care about, you know, what the issues you care about.
Well, that story was funny because it opens in the book about me being in Nevada and being so uptight and worried about me spending all of this money that I had gotten authority to spend. But again, there was no tried and true evidence that what I was doing was going to work. So when I got out there, you got to put yourself in where we were in history of the primary. We had just won Iowa by 3 million votes, but they had given that to Pete Buttigieg because he got one more delegate. Let me say that again. We had 3,000 more votes, not 3 million, 3,000 more votes. But because of the delegate math, Pete Buttigieg is deemed the winner of Iowa. So that made us a little salty. We missed getting to do what we wanted to do that night. Then we go to New Hampshire, where we're supposed to win by a bazillion, and we just barely win. So we're salty about that. And then everybody just turns and looks at me and is like, well, all that's left is Nevada. You know, you got to get these Latinos to show up. Keep in mind, nobody ever spent any money to ever get them to show up. So the pressure was immense. So I was sitting around a table with the senior staff in Nevada, and I was like, is there anything anybody in this room can tell me that we have not done? And it was hard. Because I had spent money on literally every way in the world to talk to Latinos for 6 months. And I remember a brother at the end of the table was like, you know, some years in the legislative caucus, we'll get a sound truck and drive through the – I was like, wait, yes, I've done this before, but we're in Las Vegas. And I've been down on the strip jogging early in the morning and noticed these large neon paneled trucks that have the local bar, you know, blazed with the music, rock music playing to try to advertise to all the drunks to go to the bar where this truck is advertising. I'm like, could we get one of those and then play local Mexican music from the local? Oh yeah, we could. I'm like, I don't care how much it costs. I want two of them. And I already know the neighborhoods where I want them driving around for the next 3 weeks. So that's how that all came to be.
Wow. And you also have amazing stories about how 19,000 Latinos caucused in Nevada, but you added in 30,000 who voted but didn't caucus. And then you focused on people who voted in the general election but not in the primaries. And then newly registered Latinos no one was talking to. And all of a sudden you go from 19,000 to 125,000 Latinos just in Nevada.
So starting early is the first trick, right? Maybe the first trick is having Latinos in charge of the overall campaign to make sure that everything's done. Second is starting early. Third is what I explained to people being expand the universe. We micro-target people down into a chasm where we only talk to such a small sliver of the electorate. And what I mean by that is the example you just used in this story. I knew as a 30-year senior strategist that everybody who was coming to run in this primary, if they talked to Latinos at all, because the white consultants at the table would say, let's just go talk to these 19,000 Latinos who we know are going to caucus, because I'm sure there won't be that many more that would actually even show up to caucus. So let's concentrate there. So I didn't walk away from them. I competed for them as well. But to your point, I knew there were other people that would want to participate if they were given the chance. Could I get them all? No. Could I even get half of them? No. But in a caucus where only 100,000 people probably were going to caucus, if I could get 5,000 to 15,000 new people to show up, so that means if I targeted, this is all simple Mexican redneck math, if I target 125,000 and I get 10% of them to show up, I think that's 12,500 people. That changes the caucus forever because it's just a small group of people that actually show up to these caucuses. And so I made that bet and that bet come true. When you read the book, I put you in the room the day of the caucus And throughout this book, I put you in the room, you being the listener, you being the reader, so you can feel what I'm feeling. And I remember getting reports sitting in the war room that I'd put together in Nevada as the first numbers started coming in. And I would remind everybody that the caucus was in the middle of the day. I'd gotten up that morning and I'd done MSNBC with Alicia Menendez and done two or three other hits and then showed up at the office when the caucus doors opened because I had to be there. And in East Las Vegas is where the Latino neighborhoods are. Everybody there is Latino. They're 100% Latino neighborhoods. And I had people stationed in all of those caucuses who would give me live updates because I knew if we would do good there, we were going to be set everywhere, that they couldn't beat me with white voters anywhere if I owned those precincts. And the first call started coming in, and literally the calls were, Chuck, nobody else in this caucus in East Las Vegas is getting any delegates. I'm like, what do you mean? We won everything. We won the entire caucus, and nobody got an, there's nobody who's even caucusing for anybody else. So we were winning uncontested. Now, that sounds okay, but you don't understand how hard that is in a caucus setting where you've only got 25 people in a room and you know they're the base of the activists, and there's going to be Elizabeth Warren people and there's going to be Biden, you know, because you, everybody's got crazy folks. But we won them all. I mean, wow. And nobody else even got another delegate. That's how much we dominated, which helped me write the book to say Latinos will show up and show up for you big if you go talk to them.
Right. It's just go talk to them. What did you hear from Latinos who were new to the process? What got them excited about being involved with the Bernie campaign?
Two things. Young Latinos were just embarrassed that we were living in a presidency under this man in the White House. So it started there. They're like, this is an embarrassment. This is not who we are as a country. We've got babies in cages. We are can't be demagogued as a race because we're brown. I've lived here for three generations and Donald Trump thinks of me as blah, blah, blah. Like there was just this visceral unrest around the Trump presidency. Let's start there. And then B, they didn't know that much about Bernie Sanders, to be honest, but they were open to hearing because of the way that we phrased the introduction of Bernie, of, you know, Bernie Sanders. And my first ad was this, my first mail piece was this, my first digital was this. And luckily it was in Nevada. It was actually 7 months in advance. It said, Bernie Sanders' father immigrated here from another country and he couldn't speak English and he didn't have any money in his pocket. And I would flash up these old pictures of Bernie's dad in black and white. And then I would show pictures of Latino workers. And I would say, Bernie Sanders is the proud son of an immigrant whose family's gotten to live the American dream. And when he's in the White House, he won't forget about that immigrant experience when he's fighting for us and what we stand for. And what I've just done for you there is I pulled you in on an issue that's not the number one issue of why you're going to go vote in this year's election as a Latino. But what I've done is made an emotional connection that tells you I understand you and that I'm on your level. And I never asked you to do anything other than vote for me. And all I told you was that my daddy came here, he had no money, and he couldn't speak English, which guess what, is a lot of Latinos' daddies, mamas, grandmothers, grandfathers' story. So you create likability. But because I have started early, now I can talk to them the next time a week later about, hey, let me tell you about where I stand. And then we talked about the issues they cared about. First was always Medicare for all because Latinos are underinsured at a higher rate. Then we would talk about the minimum wage. Then we would talk about the Green New Deal. And it just opened up the door to where an issue set that just aligned with Bernie's values just happened to be exactly the way the Latinos cared about it. But it was because people are like, oh, Chuck, these issues, that's why Bernie. I'm like, nope, it really had nothing to do with that. It was lucky that they did like all of Bernie's issues. But the reason they voted for him is that we went and spent a lot of time talking to them.
Mm-hmm. So Bernie won at least 10 of Nevada's 16 counties, including the most populous ones. Just quickly before we go to break, Chuck, what is the Democratic establishment, do you think, what have they learned from this?
You know, I'd like to think that they have saw that over time now that investing in the Latino vote will pay dividends. But, you know, in this presidential election, in the general election, I'm getting a little disheartened because, again, we are underfunded. people think, and I know we'll get to this, you know, Joe Biden's numbers with Latinos are a little soft. They just don't perform as well as Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. Well, let me leave you with one stat before you go to break, because we can talk about it when we come back, because it's just driving me crazy this fall, is that the top 10 super PACs in America that are doing outside work on behalf of Joe Biden are all focused on white persuadable voters. And as of July the 31st, combined, those 10 super PACs have received $500 million in donations. Wow. The top three super PACs for Latinos happen to be the only three super PACs for Latinos. And I happen to run the largest one called Nuestro PAC that I created after the Bernie Sanders primary. And us collectively, as of July 31st, have raised a combined $5 million. Wow. Now, people won't and expect Latinos to vote, and they expect for us to show up at the same percentages as white voters, but they are just not and never have invested in our community the way they do in white persuadable voters, and it's just a fact. Go check the FEC reports.
Hmm. We're talking today with Chuck Rocha, senior advisor to the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign, founder of the Nuestro PAC, and author of Tio Bernie, the inside story of how Bernie Sanders brought Latinos into the political revolution. And we are talking about what it will take to ensure a large Latino voter turnout. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are talking about how Latino activists are getting out the vote. We're joined by Chuck Rocha, senior advisor to the Bernie campaign, founder of the Nuestro PAC, and author of Tio Bernie, the inside story of how Bernie Sanders brought Latinos into the political revolution. Now I would like to also welcome Chris Santoyo to the show. Chris is a Latino activist based in Nevada who volunteered for the Bernie campaign. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Also, Marlon Mendoza is president of the LULAC chapter in Iowa City, the League of United Latin American Citizens. Hi, Marlon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Buenos dias. Thank you, Rose, for having me on.
Oh, Marlon, I'm so excited to have both of you on. Marlon, I remember watching you in a video by The Intercept earlier this year. It was an amazing video. You did so much incredible outreach canvassing with LULAC for the Sanders campaign. Tell us about what that experience was like for you. You brought together Latinos, you brought together Sudanese immigrants, meatpacking workers who came out for the very first time to vote.
Yeah, no, thank you. That experience, I still hold on to the experience very dearly. And part of the reason is because it proved to me that there is a message that can bring all people of all different backgrounds, regardless of your person of color, gender, identity, any social identifier that you want to go for, right? There is something that brings all of us together, and it was the movement and the platform that Bernie Sanders had put together. And that core message was an economic populist message. It was a message for working class people, for low-income people, people working many of these essential jobs that have to put their lives, to sacrifice themselves on the line, specifically right now with COVID and everything that's going on. Honestly, when the how it really went about, for people who don't understand caucuses or how historic this really was, this was the first time that LULAC was able, because of the advocacy of LULAC, we were able to establish three bilingual satellite caucuses, and one of them was the trilingual satellite caucus, which most people saw on The Intercept that was covered. That was due to the large push from advocacy from LULAC to ensure that we would have a space for people who English was not their primary language, but that could participate, could feel comfortable voting in the process, learning what the caucus process is like, and showing them that they belong and can participate in this process. When we did a lot of the canvassing, we literally went to the places where they live. We went to mobile home parks. We knocked on their door. We let them know, here, this is what we're trying to do. We have set up a place specifically for you to be comfortable with people that look like you in your community. Would you be willing to come out and caucus? Oftentimes when we mentioned Bernie Sanders, they were all very familiar with who he was. And the key connector here for these families was the young people. I heard talk earlier, and I think most people understand that there's 32 million Latinos who are expected to be eligible to vote this fall. And I believe 61% of that population is under 35. So really, to really get that vote from, you know, these young people, whether they're from, you know, Latino or Sudanese immigrants, it was the young people that moved the family. And many of those young people and the family showed up to the caucus, and we were able to, you know, if you watch the video, when I give, as a precinct captain, I had to give a speech in Spanish, and then my colleague had to do a speech in Sudanese. If you listen to what we were saying, it was saying that you're here because you're part of a larger movement. You're here because we're here to represent workers' rights. You know, yes, Latinos are very worried and want to have immigration reform, but there's other things that we also want for our families and our communities. That's mm-hmm. healthcare, you know, that's education, that's jobs, that's access to housing, adequate, you know, food, you know, all these other things that many people choose to not talk about or think that we're interested in the policy. One of the most beautiful things that I realized is that we are constantly told that we're very divided, that there's all these other things, but at the core of it, when you let people know we're here to support you, we're here to support you as a worker, we're here to support you as a person that is essential, that is an economic backbone to the United States, to America, people resonated with that, and they understand that there's a lot of massive reform that needs to happen within our country. And what mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders really showed us, he not only gave us hope, but he showed us that we can ask for more. If there is a possibility to say, we don't have to do things this way anymore. You know, before he ran in 2016, most people thought that his platform was ridiculous and none of this could actually be brought into the mainstream media to talk about some of these things, universal health care, free college. Fast forward to 2020, most of the candidates have adopted some form of his policy platform because they've understood that people have had enough. People need more. People need more to be able to have just an adequate, basic, you know, life here in this country. So that caucus really just, and I think part of the reason that most people after the video went out reached out to us and told us two things. One, that they had no idea that there was that many people of color in Iowa, but yes, we're here, we exist. And the second thing was that it gave them so much hope to see in a room so many different faces, black, brown, white, and showing them that it is possible to unite people for a core message, right? And, you know, I'm not surprised, Rose, that Biden, the Democratic establishment, is having a hard time either executing or with a policy, with specifically with Latinos, but even other people of color. They're not doing that great. Well, why is it? I think partially is you have to talk to them, yes, but you also have to let them know, where do I stand on this policy? How can I help you in regards to improving some of the things that I just mentioned, that Bernie Sanders really at the core was telling people that he understands that people are hurting, he understands that people are in pain, and he wanted to put some relief to that. It's not that hard, but again, it's all about will. How can you leave some of your corporate PACs and all these other money-tied interests and, you know, give us something, you know? I am not, I am not asking for a complete overhaul, but you have to show intent. You have to say that we are going to do some of these things, right? I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, after the primaries, there was, people, Latinos talking to Biden, asking him about, you know, what are you going to do about your previous immigration policy? Like, how are you going to improve that? And he got very defensive and pretty much told the voter to vote for Trump, right? People remember incidents like that. There was a campaign advisor who said that he didn't think that the Biden campaign thought that the Latino vote was a path to victory. There was an article like this back in May. So people remember those kinds of things. Now that it's crunch time and he's realizing that his numbers are not there, they're panicking and they're trying to pander to our group. And it's obvious. We can see that. But I hope that with everything, with this experience, with the fact that Bernie Sanders and other people are pushing to back Biden, obviously because, you know, it's down to Biden and Trump, and you can't just assume that you will have our vote. You also have to show that you're going to fight for it, or at least bring something to the table, right, to get people to be on your side. I know that's kind of a tangent, but that's really what happened in Iowa, and that happened in Iowa. We were able to bring a multicultural, multigenerational group to come together at a Senate caucus, and we won all the 9 delegates. We did not give a delegate away. We won all of those delegates.
Well, it was incredible to learn about the work in The Intercept, and if you have a moment, be sure to watch this video because it really is, it's incredible showing you what happened in Iowa. Chris, you are in Nevada and you started volunteering for the Sanders campaign in 2016 when you were only 15 years old. I understand that you actually convinced your family to caucus in 2020.
Yes, of course. So I was a part of the Latino outreach team when I was 15. I volunteered for their team personally. At first, I was very apolitical, not knowing much about politics at the time, considering I was young, of course. But the Bernie campaign ran a phenomenal campaign in getting young people not only to vote, but to volunteer for that campaign. And I've seen the contrary with that, with Joe Biden specifically. In Nevada, I am becoming increasingly concerned about the vote here. And Nevada is one of those special places in this country where if you live here, you could get a feeling of what direction we're going to vote. And I'm not confident enough in saying today that Joe Biden has the Latino vote locked into Nevada. Just recently, there's been many hotels laying off hundreds of thousands of Latinos in this workforce. There's no leadership. Yes, just yesterday, Senator Harris did visit Las Vegas. She only came for an hour, and she left right afterward. And when I look back on my experience with the Bernie Sanders campaign, they were always there. They were always contacting us. We were always knocking doors. We were always phone banking. And, of course, we're in a unique situation in our country's history right now with COVID-19. But I have not been called once by the Biden campaign. I have not gotten a message once from the Biden campaign. And that's all we did when I was a part of the Latino outreach with Senator Sanders. They also taught us how to speak to voters in caucuses. They taught us about his policies. They taught us about what to say in the doors. I remember a story very clearly. It was when I was 15. I was knocking on this family's door, and it was caucus day. And we were trying to get out all the votes, of course. And I was telling this family to vote for Bernie, and they kept asking me why and why. And then I started bringing forth these issues of Medicare, of education. I started having a connection with them, speaking about immigration, specifically in my family, specifically with their family as well. And having Latinos in the campaign sounds very simple thing to do, but the Biden campaign has failed to do so. Because having a Latino within the campaign makes the big difference that is needed. Because we have our stories. We have our personal stories that voters can connect to. And I think that specifically has been lacking in the Biden campaign. And I'm here to just ring the alarm bells right now, because there's a lot of people right now who are telling me they're not going to vote. There's a lot of people out here who are struggling, who can't pay their rent, who can't pay their food. They're looking for leadership, and it's just not there anymore.
Mm. So, Chris, you're hearing from Latinos in Nevada who voted for Bernie who are saying they're not going to vote?
100%. You could kind of get the direction of where Nevada is going. In 2016, I knew Hillary would win the primary. In the midterms, I knew the Democrats would win the winning Nevada, which they did. In 2020, you knew Bernie was going to win the primary. And it honestly looks, just by speaking to people, by speaking to apolitical people specifically who don't necessarily follow the news as much as we do, There's a lot of people who are saying they're just not going to vote. They're afraid that there's no leadership, that there's no solutions. They're saying things like Biden is hiding in the basement, and he hasn't visited Nevada in a couple months. It's becoming extremely concerning.
Marlene, just quickly, what are you hearing from people you caucused with in Iowa? What are they saying about the Biden campaign?
Honestly, it's very similar to what my colleague here just said. You know, the retro storm hit Iowa maybe like a month and a half ago. Before that, we have a lot of meatpacking plant workers. We have food processing workers. We have agriculture workers who are in visas. A lot of these groups of people were the same groups of people that came to the satellite caucuses. To be completely honest with you, when I speak to them about voting, it's not the first thing that comes to the forefront. They're trying to figure out, how am I going to make sure that I don't get evicted? How am I going to make sure that my kids are not behind in school because there's lack of access to internet, there's lack of access to so many things right now, specifically in a rural state. So the hardest thing for us is, how do we make the connection and tell them that it's important to vote because of all the issues that they're experiencing right now? But at the core of it is, it's the hope. The campaign, you know, there was so much hope. There was so much momentum. with the Sanders campaign, and just even before that, it's like, how do we try to find leadership? How do we try to find someone who can really take us out of this hole? And, you know, it's true. There is no leadership. There's nothing really that's going on. So a lot of the people out here, it is a struggle to get them to say, will you be able to vote? Will you be able to do mail-in ballots? Not to mention that in Iowa, if folks are following this, the Trump administration, the GOP, and at the state level are doing their best to try to add an additional barrier to the mail-in ballots. So it's a hurdle to even get the person interested, and even a more hurdle to make sure that they have their mail-in process and it's actually done in the adequate way. So it's pulling teeth, because we are practically doing the job for the campaign, and the campaign is not doing any of this work. They're not reaching out to the population. They're not letting them know this is what we're going to do to move forward.
That is Marlene Mendoza. She lives in North Liberty, Iowa, where she's president of her local LULAC chapter in Iowa City, League of United Latin American Citizens. Chris Santoyo is a young Latino activist in Nevada. He volunteered for Bernie when he was just 15 in 2016. We're also joined today by Chuck Rocha. He was a senior advisor to the Bernie campaign, author of the new book, Tio Bernie, the inside story of how Bernie Sanders brought Latinos into the political revolution. If you have any questions or comments about what you are hearing from our guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Chuck, we're getting an on-the-ground report from Nevada and Iowa. What are your thoughts?
It's not shocking. I mean, I think that what I was saying about investment matters, right? Like, I think that people don't understand a lot of times when I talk about investment, and rightfully so. They're like, oh, well, Chuck just wants to get more money for a super PAC. Yes, I do. And yes, I need more, because then I can make more mail and more TV commercials and more digital ads and more door hangers and actually take it to Latinos and give them that message. Like, I have too much at risk, and I can see that I don't have the privilege to be able to walk away from this election. If Donald Trump is reelected, I have three staffers that work under some kind of an immigration stance, whether it's TPS or DACA, that could go away. Mm-hmm. I have family members who have had COVID. Like, this is not something, sure, Joe Biden was not my first choice. He probably wasn't my second or third choice, but it's my responsibility to beat this idiot that's in the White House, my opinion, and that we have to do all we can do. And all I'm trying to stand on the tables and say is that if the Latino vote is as important as the 150 articles that I've seen written in the last 2 weeks about it, then why are we not investing in it? People don't realize that if you were to make this major investment in the Latino community, it would chase progressive politics forever. Back many, many years ago in California under Pete Wilson, when they had the English only proposition, and the outside groups came in with the local activists in California, dumped $40 million to register, educate, and then turn out Latinos, turned California blue forever. And now they have supermajorities in their House, in their Senate. We can debate how good some of those Democrats are, or how bad some of those Democrats are. But the fact of the matter is, when you invest in voters, they will turn out. If not, why are we investing $500 million to go persuade and turn out persuadable white voters? The bottom line here is, if you'll treat a Latino voter like a persuadable white voter and spend the same amount of money on that voter, you'll get twice the turnout, because we live in multi-generational family houses, and you'll just have more of a turnout overall.
Chuck, what insights can you give us about Biden's strategy to reach out to, talk to, and turn out the Latino vote? I understand that Anna Navarro, a never-Trumper Republican, is helping the Biden campaign get out the Latino vote. Are you also working with the campaign?
No, I'm forbidden to work for the campaign, because now I run Nuestro PAC. And legally, I can't officially coordinate or unofficially coordinate with them in any way after I spent the first dollar, and I haven't had any conversations with them. But my firm did interview, because in political consulting firms out there, you can put up a legal wall where you can wall off some of your staff who you don't talk to about the election, and they can work on the candidate side while you work on the IE side. And I will say that my firm, which is the largest Latino-owned firm, which did all of Bernie's mail and a lot of the digital and all the stuff that you would see us put out in English and in Spanish, we did bid on a contract with Joe Biden, and the Biden campaign decided to go with the former Barack Obama, senior official in the White House. That's neither here nor there. I ain't working for them. There's lots they could be doing. At the end of the day, they're going to spend, get this, they're going to spend more money talking to Latinos than Hillary Clinton did. The Biden campaign's probably going to spend more money talking to Latinos than Barack Obama did. But in an age in COVID where people can't be canvassing on the ground, when people don't know you like they knew Hillary Clinton, and really Latinos knew Bill Clinton, and so because of that, they liked Hillary, and they got to know Barack Obama, who was just a freaking rock star who everybody was captivated by, who ginned up turnout from the young masses, which was the reason he won. So they don't know Joe Biden, and there's in the age of COVID. So that means as a strategist, it's just common sense that you're going to have to spend even more money. And it shouldn't all be on Joe Biden, because, again, he's going to spend more money than Donald Trump, and he's going to spend more money than anybody probably has in the last 12 years running for president. But that alone won't get him there. And if that alone would get him there, why are they spending $500 million to reassure him with white voters? That's why you need both aspects of the campaign to make sure that you actually get all of that vote maximized, because there's just so much that the campaign can do on their own.
What are your thoughts on this? Sharon writes in, don't despair and keep campaigning. She says that Biden and Harris are focusing on those three battleground states that Trump won last time, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, right? Yeah, those three. Yep. What are your thoughts on that, Chuck?
The thoughts are is that a little known fact, I think that your guest would know this because LULAC has chapters there. There is a sizable Latino population in all three of those states. Currently with Nuestro PAC, we are running digital and mail to Latinos in Michigan. I looked this morning before coming on this broadcast that we're talking to 68,000 Latinos in Michigan today. We're talking to 78,000 Latinos in Pennsylvania today who are all persuadable Latino voters. Now, for all of you at home, how does Chuck Rocha know who's persuadable and who's not persuadable? Well, let me give you a little Mexican redneck insight. It's pretty, pretty easy. If you just do this basic targeting of, you know, all of these left-wing liberal Democrats like me that vote in all the Democratic primaries because I'm going to vote for a Democrat no matter what. Well, let's take all those people out of the universe because they're going to vote for Joe Biden, and I don't care what you say. Well, there's a bunch of crazy Republican Latinos who are going to vote for any Republican. There ain't many of them, but there are some who love their MAGA hats who are going to show up to vote for Donald Trump and vote in every Republican primary. Well, guess what? I'm going to take them out if they're not. I know they're not going to be with us. And then there's a sweet spot in the middle. Infrequent voters, those who vote in some primaries and not in others. So persuadable. I've also added in a bunch of, to your point earlier, Rose, about Nevada using the Teal Bernie strategies, I've added a lot of new Latinos to those universes, newly registered Latinos. So I'm trying to make up for the lack of communications of all the IE world or the independent expenditure world and a late start by Joe Biden. Joe Biden has got the plurality now in Spanish communications, but he had started 3 weeks late, which is making it slow for him to catch up. And in states like Nevada and Arizona, where Chuck Rocha and Bernie Sanders and 200 other Latinos on the Bernie Sanders campaign dumped $4 or $5 million in two states, there's a little bit of a Latino Bernie hangover. So it just takes longer to move people to Biden because they've only known Bernie because we're the only ones who's ever really talked to them.
Well, we are out of time, but we definitely want to have the three of you back because we're getting so many emails about what actually goes on behind the scenes in campaigns. Chuck Rocha was a senior advisor to the Bernie campaign. His new book is Teal Bernie. Chris Santoya is a Latino activist based in Nevada who volunteered for Bernie. And Marlene Mendoza is president of the LULAC chapter in Iowa City. Thank you all so much for joining us. We'll definitely have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.